Welcome to Making the Grade, the podcast that explores what's driving the decline in graduation rates between funding rounds and what it really takes to scale a venture-backed software startup successfully with realistic options to exit. I'm Tom Glasson, CEO at ScaleWise, and each week I'm going to be joined by founders, investors, and some of the best go-to-market leaders in the world to unpack the strategies, the missteps, and the mindset shifts that separate those who graduate from those who don't. Expect real talk, actionable go-to-market insights, and honest stories that will help you scale more wisely and thrive in an increasingly competitive market. Because there is a smarter way to scale, and we're here to uncover it. From misaligned hiring and unclear customer profiles to founder dynamics and operational growing pains, early stage startups face a whole host of challenges that can quietly derail their success before they even realize it. And when I spoke to today's guest, it didn't take us long to bond over the absolute shockers we've seen in go-to-market over the years. So much so that we've dedicated this entire episode to the five silent killers of go-to-market. And to help me unpack them, I'm joined by someone who's, I think, seen things from pretty much every angle now. Keji Mustafa is currently the CMO at Partech, who are a pioneering investment fund backing transformative tech and digital companies across Europe and Africa. And I'm also joined again by our special co-host, Munya Hoto, who's been spending some time with Keji in the Partech portcos recently too. And if you feel like you're constantly juggling clarity, customer insights, and chaotic growth expectations, then this episode is one for you. So without further ado, let's dive in. Keji, welcome to Making the Grade. It's so great to have you on the podcast. How are you?
I'm feeling very happy and sprightly. It's sunny in London town. I mean, what's not to love? I feel great. And thank you so much for having me on here. I'm really excited. This is really cool.
Awesome. Well, we've been kind of following your career a little bit over the last few years. And, you know, it looks like you've just had an incredible journey. We'd love to, I suppose, just get a bit of a whistle-stop tour for the audience, you know, through that career to date and maybe share some of the biggest milestones for you so far as well.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. So I'll start by saying I am a Nigerian, a British Nigerian, London born and raised. And as a result of being a Nigerian, I actually started off life with law on the mind. And I studied and trained to be a barrister. And that's what I was meant to be doing. But of course, I realized it wasn't the profession for me. So I've had a very unconventional journey from traditional profession to tech. And over the last sort of 10, 12 years, I think I have been working at the intersection of startups and growth, and I've worked in startups, I've supported startups, I've advised them, specifically early stage. And on the operator side, my first foray actually was thanks to my wonderful mentor at the time, Tanya Baylor, who started a company called Elvi and sort of was like, right, you're coming to join me as employee number one. I was like, what does that mean? And I had the privilege of wearing multiple hats there. I had a head of operations title, but obviously operations, you do a lot of different things. And so that was my first experience of early go-to-market and what that looks like and how you think about your ICP. And then from there, I joined Connect Ventures, which is an early stage fund headquartered in London, or based in London. And they invest seed stage, product first founders. I was there just over 4.5 years. And then I left and joined Partech, which is a multi-stage firm headquartered in Paris. And we invest right from seed through to growth. One of the really cool things about Partech in our multi-stage setup is we actually invest out of 5 independent fund strategies. So we have a seed fund, a venture fund, an Africa fund, a growth fund, and a growth impact fund. And to date, we've backed over 200 companies. And it's great. We're a generalist fund, so we have everything in our portfolio from SaaS to space. And yeah, so in short, I'd say that I've had the privilege of seeing and experiencing hundreds of startups and scale-ups over the last 10 plus years. And I think I have come to learn a couple of things about go-to-market that I've spotted some patterns over that time. And so super, super, super lucky. I have the best job. What can I say?
That's amazing. And that transition from kind of operating roles into VC, what was it that inspired that shift? Because, you know, it's not always a shift that operators are successful in making, but it sounds like you've really enjoyed that transition.
Yeah, well, I think I realized that I'm a first pirate. So I love to create things where things don't exist before. I love to be given a problem and just like, okay, figure out what that looks like. When I saw the Connect job spec, it was basically like, we need someone to come essentially be CEO of our founder network, come build, build products, build programs to support our companies. And that really just spoke to what I love to do, right? Like just figuring out ways to do things and solving problems. And so, yeah. And interestingly, I mean, I still do that now at Partech. I wear multiple hats and I just have such deep empathy for founders having been on the operator side and C-levels too. So I think it's really, I really enjoy being able to sort of bring that into the ways in which we support and help them. Yeah.
I've certainly been looking forward to this conversation. And I obviously had the privilege of meeting you in person when I came out to Paris for the Partech Unconference. I would love to hear a little bit more about your role as CMO at Partech. You know, what does a day in the life of a CMO in a fund like Partech look like? And how do you work with founders in your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, a day in the life of a CMO. In fact, any platform person is no 2 days are the same. And I know that everyone says that, but genuinely no 2 days are the same. I wear two hats at Partech. So half of the CMO function is on the brand marketing side of things for the firm. And also I have a direct reports who support the portfolio directly. And then the other half is really around our community and portfolio support and value creation. And essentially on that side of things, which is where the go-to-market piece comes in, we are really just focused on helping our founders and C-levels, what I like to call connect the dots, which is either connecting to their peers or connecting to experts or providers or whatever the case may be, with the goal being to help them make smarter decisions faster. So what that looks like right now, what I'm focused on, we have an advisory network that we use to connect the founders to help them answer questions, have think partnership. We also work on fostering talent networks, obviously to help them in terms of like their hiring and growing their teams, supporting on hiring with external partners and creating spaces much like the Unconference for peer learning so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so essentially the outcome there is like, you know, how do we help them navigate the company building journey? And key piece of that is really building robust go-to-market strategies and connecting to people who've been there, done that, so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. So that is right now what my day-to-day looks like.
You must see a lot of different companies with different problems, but what do you feel or what do you see in terms of early stage founders and where their biggest struggles are at the moment? So what would you say the kind of biggest challenges are across the portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, it's across the portfolio, but it's also, I see the same things across some of the companies that I spend time with and give think partnership to outside the portfolio. I think three things are sort of starting to take shape for me. One is market differentiation. So it's just so competitive now, right? Like if you think of the number of startups that pop up every year, it's the same for VCs. We're just in a much tougher climate on the funding side of things in particular. And so gone are the days where founders can just think about, you know, just having a really great product. Like it's not enough anymore. And I think also linked to that is the AI adoption and the pivot side of things. We have a lot of portfolio companies that aren't AI native. And so, you know, now they've got to figure out like, how do they build that layer into the product? Because the end user is going to be expecting it and they miss out on being competitive without having that. And so it's like balancing, you know, how do they think about adding that layer to their product against what they were planning on building before? So I think that AI adoption piece is a second. And then the third, which comes up again and again and again, really is operational discipline. And, you know, really deeply understanding the market that they're trying to tackle, deeply understanding the ICP they're building for, which then results in helping them build clearer go-to-market strategies and motions, which then means they're executing efficiently. So those three things are challenges that I'm seeing come up again and again and again. And I mean, the good thing is that they're not insurmountable challenges, right? This is just pinpointing it and then being able to navigate it.
You talked at the beginning, well, actually, no, you talked when we did the prep for the episode about what I think you were calling the five silent killers of go-to-market. Can you just share a bit more about those and maybe a little bit about, you know, how to combat them as well would be great.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure there are more than five, but, you know, I work in brands, so my brain likes to put things in boxes. Well, the five silent killers in my mind are sort of the things that are, again, definitely fixable, that come up again and again and again that really affect the go-to-market side of things. So number one is really an undefined ICP. And I think most founders, you know, they want to sell to everybody. Like this can be used by everyone. But if you're selling to everyone, you're selling to no one. So, you know, ICP clarity is really everything there. Number two, I'd say is premature scaling. So hiring a salesperson too soon is the one that comes up again and again. But then also, you know, potentially launching a paid channel before really maximizing and nailing the organic side of things. Again, coming to the process side of things, I think lack of go-to-market process discipline and just thinking about, okay, what are the repeatable things we need to do over and over again? How do we use data to really drive these feedback loops? I think that's a silent killer for sure. Misaligned leadership expectations. So not even just on the big picture, but even like disagreeing on go-to-market pathways and disagreeing on, you know, which countries to go to next or who to hire when, and that friction and inefficiency that causes. And then finally, which kind of links very much to the first one, is ignoring the voice of the customer, right? If you're not talking to users enough, which it's kind of crazy to me when I speak to founders, I'm like, so when was the last time you did customer discovery? Like, what does that look like? Oh, we spoke to them like a few months ago or something wild. Like, I'm like, but you need to be speaking to some subset of your customers every week. Like, this has to be happening. So they, by not doing that, they miss out on these crucial feedback loops that would also inform the product roadmap and what they're doing there. And so the ways I think about combating this, so, you know, the first one I mentioned was undefined ICP, is really tightening that and getting really, really granular and really clear early on like, who are you solving that problem for? Who are going to be like your earliest adopters, those customers that can't live without what you're building? Number two, really finding that repeatability. So the premature scaling piece. Again, I mentioned it earlier, but like, you know, not just thinking about who am I going to hire when, but also thinking about like, have we actually maximized all the organic that we can do before we start just pouring money into our paid channels? Building that go-to-market discipline so that the process side of things is, you know, what are the metrics that matter? It's all really simple things, but, you know, what are the metrics that matter? What are the things that we're doing over again that we're seeing that are working? How are we documenting this so that as new people come in, they can see these playbooks? And how are we bringing some form of structure? I think oftentimes startups are scared of the idea of structure and process. It's like, well, it's not going to feel vibey and startup-y anymore. But it's like, well, obviously, it's also going to cause a ton of chaos if you don't have some structure. So that the leadership alignment piece, setting expectations. I'm a big fan of co-founder offsites, doing them a couple of times a year just to make sure you're still on the same page and doing some questionnaires if you want to have some data linked to it. And then on the customer feedback side of things, really institutionalizing that. What are the systems that you've built to capture those insights? How do you then act on them? And again, just that structure and process around it.
Kezia, I feel like each of the five silent killers of go-to-market could be an episode on their own. And perhaps that's a good idea, Tom. We'll have to come back to that one. One of the things that strikes me as you're going about this kind of founder alignment is I was listening to Brian Chesky talk about their journey at Airbnb and how, you know, life does change as you scale. You know, you start this business with what are essentially your friends and in many ways your family. And as you scale and you grow and you professionalize the business, you know, those relationships naturally take, you know, a very different shape. And that can be hard, especially because you are all biological parents of the business in the beginning. But later, as you raise funding from great funds like Partech, your roles change. What do you see as a founder struggle with that change and that scale and that growth that are kind of the key causes of misalignment and how do they move past it? You know, you've mentioned, for example, you know, co-founder offsites as an example, but what else are you seeing that allows them to know how to handle that change in dynamic as they scale?
The way I think about it is most misalignment, and using this loosely, but most misalignment tends to stem from a couple of things. Different expectations on speed, how quickly they want to move, how quickly they want to try things, different expectations on capital allocation, what are we actually going to put this money towards, and different expectations on like what the actual growth levers are. So I think those are things that come up again and again and again. And what this looks like is, you know, one founder could maybe be pushing for really aggressive sales hiring, and the other might be wanting to focus more on like, you know, or prioritizing organic product-led growth. And then there's that friction there. So I think one of the simple fixes really is, as I was saying, with these offsites is, you know, really early discussions and transparency around what we think the go-to-market philosophy is for this company, and just interrogate that a little bit and check that they're aligned there. And also something as simple as, let's put a hiring threshold in, right? Like, so we're only going to hire X amount of people, and this is the maximum we're going to be paying them. And these are the companies who've done this already. We're going to go speak to sort of learn their best practices, like putting those in, and also being very clear on like, okay, what are the metrics of success? Because a lot of the time, like if I think about this hiring piece, you get these like fantastical JBs where you want this unicorn who's done this and that. And, you know, like, and it's kind of like, well, what are the outcomes? Like, what is it that you, by the end of year one, you want to see this person have done? And actually, when you flip it in that way, you can refine the thinking and then find alignment that way. Because when I speak to co-founders, for example, one, the CEO will be like, oh, we need someone who's like, you know, worked at Salesforce and enterprise companies and has done blah, blah, blah. And then the other's like, nah, but we're kind of focusing more on like product and product-led growth. And so already the profiles they have in mind aren't aligned. And so when you then set off on the hiring journey, of course, you're going to take ages to calibrate on like a list of even what good looks like, which means you're going to take ages to fill the role, which means that you're just like burning time, burning cash. And all of this can help avoid like costly strategy pivots later on. So yeah, there's some of the ways I would tackle that one.
Mm. And just kind of double clicking on that hiring challenge as well. We've seen it too many times where founders probably too early, and you touched on this in terms of hiring salespeople, but too early, they are kind of outsourcing or delegating the sales leadership challenge, you know, and they're hiring a VP sales or a head of sales before they've really got that repeatability and that product market fit. You know, our strong view is that, you know, the founder is the best person to win those first few customers, to iterate around the product market fit, to ultimately get to the point where there is some sort of a playbook that can be handed over to a VP sales rather than just magically thinking they're going to come in and fix it for them. When do you think it makes sense to hire your first kind of leaders into that go-to-market team? Because it can, as you said, be a really, really costly mistake if you don't get that timing right. But yeah, how do you know when the time is right to hire and at what level?
I mean, it's the age-old question, and there's never a perfect answer to this, but there's sort of three ways that I think about it, which would be one, to the point you mentioned, is there enough repeatability in the pipeline to justify it? And, you know, have you found that ICP that wants to keep buying over and over again? Like, do you have enough of that repeatability? Are you fully clear on your sales motion? Is it outbound? Is it inbound? Is it product-led growth? Like, because again, sometimes I think founders try and mix the two. And, you know, I'm all for a culture of rapid experimentation and testing things, but there needs to be some sort of clarity on like the sales motion you want to follow. And then the third one in my mind, which is like pure numbers, is like, can you afford 12 months of runway even with this hire? Which means that then if you make a bad hire, you know, it's not going to like completely torpedo the company and you're out of cash. And this is where like advisors and networks really come in. And because you can lean on operators who've done it before. So oftentimes I'll say to founders like, you know, have a chat with the CRO or the VP sales at XYZ company because they've done this a couple of times before and they can be very honest about their own story and their own journey. And then also speak to other founders who brought this role on to get a sense of what mistakes they learned and what they would do differently. But essentially, like using your network, using advisors, using operators to help you calibrate the sort of profile that you're looking for.
Yeah. And you touched on something that's so important there, Keji, which is that really clarifying the profile of the leader that's needed. And I think that's often where the mistake gets made is this, you know, this term chief revenue officer gets thrown around a lot and everyone thinks they need a CRO, but actually people don't really understand the differences between a head of sales, a VP sales, you know, a CRO and the type of profile, as you say, that's needed at different stages of that journey. And often they're maybe overhiring. And our firm belief is that leader stage fit is probably one of the most important things you need to get right. And there's probably founders who might be listening to this and realizing that they've maybe got it wrong as they hear what we're talking about. What do you believe they should do next?
I mean, first of all, you're not alone. I think I've definitely made wrong hires, not as a founder, but I've definitely made wrong hires, and a wrong hire is a wrong hire. And I think the first thing is just asking yourself and being really, really self-aware of, was it a wrong hire? Or to your point of leader stage fit, like, was it the wrong stage of hire? So that's like the first one, almost like a little decision tree. If it was the wrong hire, that's fine. Just make the change as quickly as possible. And just accepting that, you know, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. So there's going to be a trade-off somewhere. Figure out what that trade-off is, make that switch. If it's wrong timing, then it's more resetting your expectations and giving that individual like, okay, we might have kind of fluffed a little bit where we were in the journey. And so that obviously has impacted what we said you were going to be doing. So we're going to reset expectations. We're going to, you know, re-clarify and give specific missions of like what we need to see in the next X amount of time. And then just adjust the role to fit current needs. I think part of the challenge is that most founders, get super obsessed with shiny logos. Of course, we're in an industry where shiny logos matter. And they're like, oh, I'm going to bring on the CRO from, I don't know, insert any of the greatest companies in the last decade or so. But the question is also, well, to the point you made earlier, like, you're the founder, so you're doing most of the sales at the beginning. And so when you then step off that track and bring someone else in, you need someone who's going to be able to roll up their sleeves and really jump into it. So a CRO is great once you have a team of SDRs and account execs and all those things to lead that and give the structure around that. But in that first grassroots moment, you need somebody who can literally roll up their sleeves and can go from, you know, doing the cold calling or whatever the case may be to writing up the playbooks of how the process works. And so not getting excited about a shiny logo per se, but actually looking more of the journey of what that person has done. And one tip that I learned early on at LV from the wonderful Aunt Andrew Banks at Faraday Partners, he said, oftentimes look at the number two or the number three from that super shiny person that you're after, because that person is the person who's been in the trenches doing it. And that person will be excited at the opportunity to, you know, you're going to sell them a dream, like you're going to lead this, the build out. Don't give out titles too early, of course, because then you have a problem of you have nowhere to go. But yeah, look at the number two or number three beneath the person that you think is like the gold standard and start there, because you'll probably find a real diamond in the rough.
Boy, oh boy. I mean, we could definitely dwell on this one. You know, I'm thinking about just when I work with some of our customers, you know, that job title inflation at that early stage is, again, a very common misstep, and often in lieu of like a good salary. So, you know, there's so many ditches that you can kind of end up falling.
No solutions, only trade-offs. So I guess what trade-off people are willing to make is the inflated titles instead of salary.
100%. You know, going back to these five silent killers, you mentioned something, and it's a common theme that we hear across industry, including VCs, is this idea of focus on customers and keeping track of customer trends and feedback. I like to think of it, you know, like any good relationship. You know, my wife does not want me to pull an all-nighter on contact. You know, she'd like to be told I love you, you know, every so often rather than waiting until her birthday or Valentine's Day. And I often think founders are the same way. I feel like when they get busy with hiring and building process and structure, the customer becomes that distant memory that, you know, why did we start this in the first place? What problem are we solving? You know, what pain were we trying to address? And, you mentioned the importance of regularly speaking to your customers. I just wonder how do you make sure you get that right and get that information from customers, which actually makes a difference to the business, but also just keep up the rhythm and regular cadence of keeping that a priority as a founder or CEO?
Definitely. I mean, I think one is just forcing yourself to actually want to speak to customers. And if you are looking at your diary and you don't see at least like every fortnight or so, at least one customer call, like as an early stage founder, I think that's a red flag and you should go and interrogate that immediately. But firstly, I think it's really treating customer conversations like sales calls. And one thing I think sales does really well is sales at its best is very structured, right? It's repeatable. You're using data around that. So treating those calls in the same way. So they're structured, the questions you're asking, you're repeating them in the same way, and you're using the data to inform like how the questions then inform what you go off and do from there. I think the second point is really asking the right questions in the right way. And that is asking questions about their pain points, about their buying process, about what would make them want to switch. Those are the questions to be asking. And it always astounds me how few people have heard of or read The Mom Test, Rob Fitzpatrick. It's like such a short book, but so, and I'm going to shout out Matt Lerner, who first introduced me to that. I think it like my first couple of months at Connect. And he was like, yeah, this is such a simple fix. Everyone should read it. And I've read it too. And I use the same structure and process when I'm doing customer discovery with our portfolio. So yeah, it's like the quality of the questions and how you're asking them. And then finally, which always I find bizarre, is don't just ask happy customers. Go speak to the customers that you lost, or, you know, the users that churn, because there's so much insight in that too. And it's the same with even like when exit interviews, when companies don't do them. I'm just like, why? This is the perfect opportunity to get insight from someone who's leaving, who has no skin in the game, and they'll just say it to you outright. Now, what you choose to do with that information is a different question, but taking that information really does help.
I couldn't agree more just on this idea of spending time with customers. A couple of times when I've been at an offsite, you know, when I've been in role as a CMO and we bring a customer along, I've been surprised how many people outside of GTM have ever spoken to a customer or ever heard from a customer. And we often used to, in previous roles, get everybody to just put up their hand and say, who has ever heard from a customer or spoken to a customer? And 70% of the room, you know, has never even really actually spoken to the person they're engineering for, the person they're supporting, you know, with innovation from a product perspective, etc. And bringing those people into the room for those customer offsites, for those resets of vision, for those strategy sessions was always a game changer, because it brings a level of connectedness to the problems we're solving that I think nothing else can actually do than actually speaking directly to the customer, asking them questions and spending time with them.
I absolutely agree with that. And actually, one of the portfolio companies from Connect, they did a fantastic job where every season, I don't know how they define season, but I guess it was a couple of times a year, they would have product engineering join customer calls or like deal with some of the tickets with the support team. And I thought that was so simple. It was a simple idea taken seriously, which is, to your point, how do we make sure more of the company, more of the team are also hearing the customer's voice like live and hearing it directly as opposed to indirect feedback from the other teams? And I think it also gave a level of empathy across the different functions in the company, because then, you know, the product team realized, well, this is the challenge that the sales team have because they have to sell this stuff on calls and they, you know, customers are asking for things. The natural reaction is be like, yeah, we can build that. We can build that. You can hear from the customer support people like, this is why we keep stressing you out, product, that we need this feature because it keeps coming up in tickets. So I definitely think like how you figure out a way for across every discipline in the company to be able to experience the customer discovery side of things at some point, I think is game changing. And so yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that point.
Yeah, and I've seen this in real life, actually. I was CRO at a company a few years ago, and a part of every engineer, every product person's onboarding was they had to sit on customer calls. And actually, it did, like you said, Keji, it became a quarterly thing that they had to consistently do. And I tell you, I've never worked with a product and engineering team that had so much empathy and so much understanding than that team there. And it really made us move faster. It made us focus on what the customer needs were. And actually, it just built mutual trust and understanding across those different, which sometimes can be quite siloed departments. And I think it's a game changer for businesses when they can start getting that exposure to the customer. So thank you for bringing that up. So just looking at 2025 kind of trends and predictions, what are your predictions for go-to-market this year? And I suppose, what changes are you seeing across your portfolio? Because it is still a bit of a strange year, certainly in B2B tech. You know, we had this kind of bubble of 2020 and 2021, 22. We've seen that kind of since crash, and the funding environment is still tricky to navigate, I think, for a lot of startups. Valuations are certainly compressed, and there's a lot of pressure on go-to-market efficiency and people really getting their unit economics in a better place. So, yeah, what are your predictions for this year? And yeah, as I say, what are the changes that you're seeing across your portfolio?
I will share my predictions, but I reserve the right to update them as I get more data. I never have any problem putting thoughts out into the world and changing my mind. But genuinely, what I think or feel, just seeing what I'm seeing, is obviously AI is a big piece. I think AI-driven personalization is going to be top of mind for everyone, especially non-AI native companies. And, you know, more go-to-market motions that are going to be powered by AI, AI-led targeting, sales enablement, outreach, all that great stuff. So yeah, AI is here to stay. I think as a result of that, there's going to be also a shift to high-touch engagement. So really the community around your products and sort of adding an element of community-led growth on top of whatever your motion is already. I think because it's just such a great way to avoid paid marketing. If you can sort of really foster your community, then you can create great content, great stories around them. And so that's a back to the capital allocation piece. And then I think linked to that is, I feel like we're going to see a PLG plus. And I don't know if to call it that, but that's kind of how I see it in my head, where your obviously product-led growth is great go-to-market strategy, right? Because it's cost-effective, it's fast, it's streamlined, all that great stuff. But there's going to be, I think, a sort of blend between product-led growth and sales-led growth motions and models. And so I think I'm just calling that PLG plus just for buzziness. But yeah, those are the three predictions I have in terms of go-to-market for 2025.
Yeah, so much talk about AI. Munya, I know you've got some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by when internally organizations, you know, kind of supercharge their teams, particularly by leveraging AI. Keiji, I know that we could talk for hours and hours and hours, and I would love to, by the way. So we definitely need to get you back for more of this. But as we kind of get to the wrap up of this episode and zooming out a little bit, you know, you get to work on the industry and in the industry, which I think is a very privileged position. And so your perspective is incredible. If you could change one thing about the startup ecosystem, what would it be and why?
Leaving the obsession of growth at all costs behind to sustainable scaling. And I know that that's like, you know, at this point, everyone's saying that, but I think it there's a reason why everyone keeps saying it, because it's true. And I think if more founders were to focus more on like the quality of the growth versus just the speed, and you need to have a balance of both, but not be so obsessed with the speed that you're just growing great, but burning stupid money. I think that's a shift we're seeing. And I think, you know, we're seeing it also in terms of, but definitely, I know that from our perspective, like our growth team in particular, they really spend time really understanding like the capital allocation and how a founder thinks about that. And so I think there's more weight being put on that now versus just looking at the end, you know, the numbers of like, you know, the speed at which you're growing. And I think that's one shift that I hope continues. I can't see why it wouldn't continue, especially looking at the macro environment and how much harder it is to raise follow-on funding. So yeah, I'd say just shifting that obsession from growth at all costs to sustainable scaling.
And you did then touch on how much harder it is to raise follow-on funding. And this podcast is called Making the Grade. It's quite a worrying trend downwards. We'd love to get your thoughts on, like, what do you think needs to happen to improve the graduation rates in startups?
I mean, I don't think it's going to be just one thing, but I think one of the biggest reasons startups fail is because they never truly find product market fit, right? Like they mistake early traction for product market fit. And so they then go off and hire people and then build teams and try and go to new markets before they have that true product market fit. So I think it goes back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, like really understanding your customer, really understanding like who you're building for, you know, not hiring too early, not moving to paid before you really maximize everything that organic can do. So yeah, I think like really moving the focus to longer term fundamentals and not vanity metrics. So going back to figuring out like, what are the metrics that really matter? How are we going to know that we're hitting it? And you know, all those different things that we've talked about over this episode.
Oh, Keiji, you have brought optimism and energy to this program. So thank you so much for joining us for Making the Grade. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. You have dropped insight after insight. And as Minya said, we could probably run an hour episode on all of those five go-to-market silent killers. And we would love to have you back at another time. Wishing you all the best in your role at Partech. And hopefully we catch up again soon.
Thank you. Thank you. This was so fun and love what you folks are doing at ScaleWise and with Pavilion as well. Like I love it. I'm a big, big, big fan. I will love to chat with you whenever. Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you so much for listening to Making the Grade. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you have any questions following this episode or you'd like to recommend a guest perhaps for our next season, please let us know at podcast@scalewise.com. And if you did enjoy today's episode, please do consider leaving us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'd really appreciate that. As this is a brand new show, reviews really help us spread the word and reach new listeners. Plus, we'd also love to hear what you're enjoying about our show. Thank you so much for your support and see you soon for another episode of Making the Grade.